This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast on a big blockbuster week. We've got some big things to talk about this week. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, Dune Part 2, and the new roguelike that's taken over my life, which I'll tell you all about later. But first, anyone watching Love is Blind Season 6?
I am, yeah. Always, I love that show.
I never really watched Love is Blind, but for some reason I just needed something to turn my brain off with like this week, and I was like, I'm going to watch this. They're just all doomed, aren't they? It's never going to work.
It'll be like every season where like one or two of them will make it, but then the majority of them, you can already see the writing on the wall for a lot of them. You're like,
it's just, I get the experiment. It's a fun reality show. That isn't how life works. It's not going to happen. It's not going to work
that's this. Do you know what? When I saw there was a new season, I was like so excited because it's the show that me and my wife watch together and we just bitch about everybody on the show. It's like, we don't watch many reality shows, but it's one we do like.
So if there is one very cute couple who it could actually work, but they just seem like two nice people. I don't know if they're actually a good couple.
I think I know which ones you're talking about. And I think we watched it last night and we're like, boring, move off, just go get married. I don't care. I want the ones with the drama. And I like the ones where there's a love triangle and then they meet the other person in real life afterwards. Oh. That's when it really gets spicy.
Are you a big fan? Love is Blind, another drama. It's your cup of tea, Matt.
I'm not, no. Reality TV is not my bag.
It isn't for me either, but for some reason, like once a year, I watch like one season of these Netflix things, and I'm like, that's my fill for the year, I think.
The Ultimatum's good as well. We watch that too.
What one's that one?
It's just where there'll be loads of couples on there who have, one of them wants to get married and the other one doesn't. And so it's like, I present you the final ultimatum. And what they do is they all swap.
is that how a relationship works?
But they all, if you don't marry me, I'm gone. They all swap partners and like they get to live with someone else for like 3 weeks to see what life would be like with someone else. And then they go back to their original partners and see, okay, now do I actually want to marry you or not? And sometimes they do. Sometimes they fall in love with the person that they actually get hooked up.
How can you do that?
It's mad. It's mad.
Like, I would tend to suggest if you need to go on to a reality show and give your partner an ultimatum of like, in a week, if you don't marry, I'm gone, then your relationship's probably not in the right place.
Absolutely. These people are always extremely naive to the situation. And it's just, yeah, and a lot of the times they all want to do these shows because they want to be famous.
It's just a way to become famous. Well. Yeah. Exactly.
But yeah. I like that because they all do stupid things because of that, and it makes for fun television. So, good.
Yeah. Well, there we go. There's a little, the yearly Netflix reality romance bump for them. I'm sure they need it. I'm sure that's probably what most people watch on Netflix these days, isn't it? It's either murder documentaries or romance reality. Yeah. So, there we go. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. I said it right. There we go. A little bit of romance in that, if you like going on dates with dogs or women or men.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll get onto that later, I'm sure. But I think we can all agree, we all very, very, very much enjoy this game. Not to say it doesn't stumble in places, but we all think it's a very fun game. Should we start with about what we love about this game first, which is, I don't know, where do we want to start? Do we want to start with the combat? It's still good, isn't it?
Yeah, I find it so hard to talk about the things I love because I just, honestly, I find that in life in general, but I just enjoy them. And it's the niggly things that I always have things to say on. But
okay, well, we'll get on to the nitpicks
later. I know. This is something I thought last night that I'm sure you guys are in agreement with. I think it like might be one of my favorite open world to like, just in terms of like how the areas are built, because they're so packed They're so dense, and each one's so uniquely designed in how you get around them and maneuver around them. And I always feel like I'm discovering like new crevices, new corners. It's like complete opposite of these, like, especially Final Fantasy 16, which are just flat landscapes.
It has. Sort of, I think, takes you by surprise in the fact that the very basic fundamentals of, you know, there's six is the kind of open world hubs that are in this world, and you work out what you need to do in them by activating towers, which is the oldest trick in the open world book at this point, and feels like it should be really like trite and old hat and boring. And whilst, you know, kind of like actually activating those towers is exactly what you've done in Far Cry, each one's a little bit different to climb, and then you activate it and it puts things on your map. I think what you said, Dale, is these maps are constructed not like typical open worlds. They're almost, it's not as twisty and knotty as God of War's level design, but if you spread that out over a much larger place, it's kind of got a bit of that to it. You can't just beeline from A to B. Getting from A to B will always require you to find like an interesting route, which might require you to use a chocobo that has a unique ability. It might require you just to think a little bit about how am I going to climb this area? How am I going to navigate? Or it might require sort of like fighting through different sort of enemies and stuff like that. And the fact that it's never a case of just follow my compass direction, it makes you feel really engaged. Yeah. And when I was talking about it at preview, I spoke about this. By them adding in stuff like the climbing and sort of like being able to like swim and stuff like that, while a lot of that is a bit too slow for its own good, it adds this sense of adventure. And everywhere you've got to go in the open world, it feels like you are on an adventure. And it helps that everybody tags along with you. So you've got this big group of kind of by the end of the game, like eight people tagging along with you. Each one has their own climbing animation, swimming animation, walking animation. And it really feels like those moments in like Lord of the Rings when you've got the shots and the entire fellowship is tracking across the world.
Yeah.
It gives you that. And so I think it's an open world that is consistently engaging because of that.
And each one...
Yeah,
Sorry, Caddy, go on.
Even like each area has its own quirk, like you say, to get around. And not all of them are great. Some of them are a little annoying to get around. But at least I do like that this game, even till pretty much the very end, is throwing new things your way and new things to do. And like a lot of them are completely optional, but it never, I can safely say it never, maybe only once or twice for like 20 minute stretches was I ever close to bored in this game. It's always giving you something different to do. And it's like fundamentally that combat is just one of my favorite combat systems in any game. And it's pretty much the same as Remake with a few new wrinkles added. But I just enjoy playing it so much. That's the thing. Like, even when the story isn't progressing too much, I enjoy playing this game so much. And that's, you know, it's a game. You want to enjoy playing it, right? And I just, like I said, even in each area, like, you'll have a similar checklist of things to do. Like you said, like, there'll be, like, these proto-relic quests, which are, at first glance, you can, like, dismiss as, oh, they're just, like, open-world filler stuff, I think. But then, I don't know what happened on Google Meets there. A little
bubble just popped up on your screen. What was it? It wasn't, yeah, it wasn't, I
don't
Google.
I don't know what I pressed there. Look, stop me in mid-thought, but it just got, I saw all of our faces just go, what happened there? But anyway, so I'm talking about open world quirks, and they're like, there's this list of, like I said, like these proto-relic quests that are in each region. There's like four per region, and I think at first you could dismiss them as just open world filler and just like go here, collect this thing for someone, or go here and beat this thing for someone. But in each region, they're a completely different type of quest, and I like that they didn't just... It would have been very easy for them, for example, to do... Don't want to keep comparing it to Final Fantasy 16, but like it would be... Those side quests were the same thing the whole way through, and they were basically all fetch quests. Yeah. Like these were... There's so much better variety, and not all of them... like you said in your preview, Matt, not all of these mini games and quests are pinnacles of game design, but they're all varied enough that you're not doing the same thing 20 times in a row. You'll a maximum probably do the same thing four times.
For a game that is, you could potentially play this for 100 hours. And I do feel that every single hour of your play, it's not that you're going to be doing something completely different every single hour, but I think you're never going to have a sequential set of like 4 hours where you're doing the same thing for 4 hours. It feels like every 30 minutes, even in the main quests, and sometimes it asks you to do some shit.
Yeah.
Like there's a bit later, quite far into the game, where you just have to spend about 20 minutes throwing boxes, and it's really bad. But immediately either side of that are completely different activities that you'll be doing. Some of that will be very combat heavy, some of it will be very exploration heavy, and then you'll go into a section which is very dialogue heavy, and then you go into the open world where every third quest that you're doing is like a weird mini game that you'll play once and never see again.
Yeah,
it's so really many strange
mini-games. Like the main story at times, like they are mini games. A lot of them are optional, but at times you're like, you will be spending 2 hour stretches just playing mini games, which I enjoyed because I find them fun and I'm having fun playing this game. But I do see it does slow the plot down. We'll get onto probably story later because that's where quirks will happen. But like, I just want to talk about the characters, and I feel like they do, and this kind of links to story. They do such a, like, if people don't know, I've only ever played the first like few hours of the original Final Fantasy from 97. So I don't have a great connection to these characters apart from in Remake. So you guys love the original to death and know it inside out. Like, I thought this game did such a great job. More than like, I never felt in the first game I had a fantastic time. I loved it, but the characters, I was like, oh, these are a cool group of characters. This game does such a great job at connecting you to those characters, I think, through side quests, through the main story. And I really do like care about all these characters now, and it made the main story at times mean more. And there's just, I don't know if this has always been the case, and I'm probably like regurgitating old news. Like, to me, Cloud is the worst character in this game, and everyone around him is better. but that's how I felt in this one.
Not
anyway.
Sure about that, but I would say this is the best portrayal of these characters. And me and Matt have spoken about it. This idea of, like, you know, when you got 30 years of these characters being out in the world, it makes it a little bit easier to refine them and make them more palatable. Like, I think, personally, from the original game, like, I had no attachment to Yuffie at all in the original game. I never had any interest in her. But all of a sudden now, in this game, through some of the clever writing and characterization that I've done, I've grown attached to these characters, like, way more than
I ever
have.
She could so always easily just be irritating, and she's not. And
there's
like,
times where she's irritating, but like, ultimately, you understand her character. She has more dimensions to her. Yeah. You understand, like, why that part of her personality exists.
And there are moments where it leans a little bit on emotional blackmail at times, but most of the time I think it works. Like, there's even bits like, I don't really care about these characters. There's one bit where, like, the end of side quest, I was just playing, I think it was Aeris theme on the piano to some cats, and I felt myself like choking up. It was like, why do I care about this so much? I was like, I only just like, I haven't known these people long. But yeah, and Barrett, I just love Barrett and his storyline in this.
I think the writing has been significantly improved, and obviously the original English language version of it was full of like weird translations and stuff, and also like very, even though some of these characters are still stereotypes to a certain degree, like it was even worse than the original. So like, these years of refining this dialogue and making their interactions so much more palatable, like Red 13's side story is like one of my favorite stories from the original, and I just think they've just expanded on it and made it even stronger this time around. And
was that always in the main? Like, well, all the, that's what, yes, I have a question. We're not spoiling it for people. Like, are all these, because all these quests on the mainline path with these characters, they seem like they might once upon a time have been side stories, or are they always just part
only,
of the
main story? So Yuffie's was a side story, and Vincent's, but they were optional characters as well. Mm. But everything else was part of the main story, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. We can talk about story now, because you guys probably have more to say about this than me. Like, I enjoyed the story. I do feel like for long stretches, it does put the main threat into the background. You're kind of left at times thinking, like, what are we actually, like, what is the main goal here? Yeah. Like, where is Sephiroth? He goes missing for long stretches. But this, I don't know if that's how the original game was, and that's kind of an inherent problem of this middle section.
Yeah, essentially. So the worst thing that you can say about the plot of this game is that there is no plot, because it is taken from a section of the original game in which they have established that Sephiroth is a villain and they probably need to stop him. And this is a almost slightly aimless journey to pick up a bunch of characters, each one that has their own motivation to help Cloud stop Sephiroth. And it's really only when you get to the end of this section of the game that it starts to clarify why Sephiroth is such a distinct threat. Well, when you turn that section, which I would say is probably about 8 to 10 hours of the original game, when you turn that into, at bare minimum, a 30-hour RPG, which is kind of if you just play the story, at max a 100-hour RPG, you do have a game that sort of feels like it's just spinning the wheels for a certain amount of time. But I feel if you can look past that and play this as a character piece rather than a plot piece, then what you're going to get is lots of segments of characters being introduced and it explaining why you should care about these people and why you should care about the world they're from to make the much more apocalyptic third game feel like it's worth going into.
I would say this this game definitely feels more like you're playing Mass Effect, but you're just doing the loyalty missions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's very like, and I remember thinking that in the original game as well. I was like, okay, now we go to Red 13's home. Now we go to Barrett's home. Now, like, and you do loyalty missions with all these people. Mm-hmm. And like Matt said, it's only really at the end that we're like, okay, now we're starting to put things in order of where we're heading, what we got, what our goals are.
I will say, though, it did kind of, I wouldn't say it ever frustrated me because I was just always enjoying where the story went, like all the funny places it went. Like you go to a place like Costa del Sol and Gold Saucer and just have a fun time. Like it never truly frustrated me. I was always having a good time. I think that's because it reminded me of what I like about like a Dragon and the Persona game so much is I just like kind of hanging out with my friends in those games. And that's what you do a lot in this game is kind of, you're like, they know it's ridiculous at times. There'll be lines like, oh, can we just go and have fun in this amusement park? And Cloud's kind of like, ugh. But everyone's like, yeah, let's do it. And you're kind of like, yeah, let's do it. Why not? Let's have some fun. We're not going to obviously spoil what happens at the end of this game. Neither really what happens in the 97 original or in this one, or how, if at all, it differs. But like, I think we can all agree, and I think that's been the consensus I've seen in almost every review, is like, the ending's just messy, right? It doesn't necessarily give you, and that's the, I think that's probably the most frustrating thing about this game is you can have dozens and dozens of hours of fun, but it doesn't quite land its ending.
It biffs it, is what the actual term you're looking for is.
Yeah.
It's a mess. It is a very clunky mess, and we've been speaking about it already and saying like this idea of trying to create ambiguity and, you know, leave you with questions and stuff, but it's going too far down that direction. Mm-hmm. And there's times where you just need to be clear.
I also think it took me a while to come around on the end of Final Fantasy Remake. You know, that was a game which essentially breached fate, which meant that anything could happen in this second game. This second game is, I would say, between 85 to 95% just a straight remake of the original game. And obviously much more expansive because it's a huge new RPG with modern like storytelling techniques, modern graphics, modern combat techniques. So it is much bigger and expansive, but it is still, for the most part, the same story with the final 5 hours of the game, which is where it goes a bit skew-iff. And so I'm starting to question what the value of doing this whole breaking of fate and it's not going to be the same as what you remember is, when so much of the game is brilliant as a just straight up remake in the same way that the Resident Evil games
remake. It's like they're
kind
of caught in between two stools, right? It's either be completely faithful or just go bonkers with it, and they're kind of in between.
I do feel like kind of conned a little bit because I really love this game and I love the original, and it's because it's replicating a lot of the original. Mm-hmm. But they did end the first one by saying the unknown journey will continue, and the implication was forget everything you know about the original, we're going in a completely different direction. And I thought, oh, we'd see all the same places but everything would be different. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's not that at all. And so it is a little bit disappointing in a way, because I really didn't like the ending of Remake, but that promise made me excited for what I was going to see. And I really love Rebirth, but it's not what I thought it was going to be.
But like, I should emphasize, no matter how much I don't speak for you, no matter how much I think it does stumble the last half an hour to hour, I still had, 57 to 58 amazing hours with this game. I couldn't stop playing it. I was having so much fun. That is largely down to that combat, which, like, if you don't remember how to play that game, it took me a few hours to learn how to defeat big bosses again. It's like all about building up that stagger bar, basically, and then just once you get it, dropping Infinity's End on them, basically, to smash them to bits.
It's straight up. It's the best combat the Square team have made for Final Fantasy since ATB existed in 1997. I think it is like the way that it combines the real spirit of what Final Fantasy is with those kind of command based things with an action system that by and large feels really strong and punchy to use. It has each of its characters, I cannot believe that, you know, it adds another three playable characters in. Each one of them feels absolutely nothing like any of the existing characters to play. Red 13 has this really interesting hybrid between defense and offense, and you keep him defensive for a certain amount of time of the fight, and then you can unleash all of that, like, harnessed defensive power into attack. Yuffie is so fast, and you can use her as both a ranged or close attacker. And she's, as I say, completely different. Is, you know, you would think maybe she's a bit like Tifa because she's a martial artist. Absolutely nothing like it. And the way they've done that, but the other thing that they do that I really love is the new wrinkle of the combat system are these synergy abilities. And over time, you can build kind of out this skill tree that allows certain characters to do certain special moves with each other. They are incredible because not only do they give you interesting boosts through the battle, so there's one I constantly used between Cloud and Tifa that would which would remove MP costs, so they could then cast as much magic as they want for a period without it costing them anything. But they also do stuff that allows you to extend the stagger period on enemies, which is where you can deal 200% extra damage. So doing all of that felt really beneficial to that combat system and really gave it interesting wrinkles. But also, the thing I love about this game is it's a game about a bunch of friends doing what it takes to kind of like take on big problems in the world. And having a combat system that allows the animations to really show these people working together.
That's what I was gonna say,
the animations are incredible. It's astonishing. And it, like, it always does something that's just really fun. There's one between Aerith and Barret where they stand back to back and they put sunglasses on. And it's so fun.
That's the exact one I was going to say. Yeah. Like, and they can't, it all happens so quick and there's so much effects on screen. You kind of can't properly see it until like I've had to slow down video and watch it, basically. But it's just all, it's just all very fun. Like, that's the main takeaway I have in this game. It might sound just very basic.
I think you're absolutely
language,
right.
But like, it's just so fun.
It really captures the sense of fun that Final Fantasy games have just lost over the years. Like, they're so po-faced. And this game, like, has moments where it's really po-faced and serious, but it knows how to have an amazing laugh all the way through it. Like, everybody's not just the players having fun, the characters are having fun a lot of the game as well. And then you compare it. God, when was the last time in a Final Fantasy game when they had fun? Maybe 12, maybe? Like, even then.
Even 12 is very heavy. Like, I think 10 is quite honestly the time when you feel like there was actual genuine joy in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And it's like,
and a lot of that can come through Queen's Blood, which I should add is an excellent card game.
Yeah, I want to retract my statement that I made on Queen's Blood during preview, because I said that I didn't think it was going to be very good. It's actually a really, really well thought out deck builder.
Yeah, it's so, and it has its own, again, it's like, this game does have surprises. Like, don't sleep on it. For the first time, a few times you play it, you might be like, oh, this is a cool, fun game, I'll leave it. But like, it actually has its own side story and side quest to follow through right until the end. That's actually quite cool. So
a lot of the game, a lot of the side quests and stuff like have that in that game, which I'd say it's like, so I blasted through the main story, man. And like, the main reason was because I wanted to, because we're working on an end and explain video and I wanted to get to that as quick as possible. But since then, I've gone back and put nearly 30 hours of extra stuff, just going around doing all the side quests. And I'm always surprised at how much effort in terms of storytelling is put into side quests. A lot of they could just make fluff side quests, go and do this, go and do that. But every one of them has some sort of character relationship or building or story from the past or character from the first game that's come back and they're involved in some way. Although it is mad how easily all these people who lived in Midgard get around, even though it seems like the biggest challenge in the world for you to get around. It's like Chadley is everywhere. Yeah. Like, that guy just nonstop.
Yeah, there's a lot of suspension of disbelief you have to do in this world. Yeah, once you do it, you'll have a great time. And I will also add, like, I think bizarrely, Square did say this is a standalone game, which it technically is. You can buy it and play it by itself, but I think you'd be so lost if you haven't played the first game.
I think a lot of people are lost if you haven't played the original game. I think you can still just about muddle your way through.
I got it. It was only when, obviously, when we're talking, it's only the very ending where, like, you've had to explain, like, a few, and I still knew what was going on, but, you know, it doesn't mean as much to me, basically. But yeah,
but the idea of it being standalone, it is absolutely not, but it does stand head and shoulders above Final Fantasy 16. I think I'll reinforce that.
Definitely.
I know I said that when we were talking about this at preview that I'd found 16 disappointing. I cannot believe how far in advance this is over 16. This is exactly what, in many ways, I think my ideal Final Fantasy VII remake is this game with the full story in it. Mm. You know, kind of like allowing that full story. I think you can play the original Final Fantasy VII in about 30 hours. So I'd say kind of a nice 60-hour version of that with these big, expansive open mm-hmm. worlds would have been my ideal way of doing this. But hopefully whatever comes next improves on it. But if that one completely biffs it, this one is my ideal type of Final Fantasy and has been my favourite since.
Could they 10. Just use this formula for the next one? I don't know how many different regions it's got. Obviously, I don't want spoilers or anything. Like, could you just run with it?
There's not as many more regions. There's probably about three major places left to go to, really. So like Medeal, Rocket Town, where the Icicle Inn is, the snow area, mm-hmm. and then like all the end game stuff. But I suspect they're going to do bigger. I suspect Rocket Town is going to be way more significant in the.
And I suppose it depends how they what they add, right? Without I'm trying to really dance around these about what other places you might spend time in with other people.
Well, I'm genuinely hoping that they fulfill what I thought was going to be happen in this game, whereas they completely mix it up in the next one. And yes, you visit the same locations, but the story goes in its own way. Mm-hmm. I would be excited to see that. But
there's a lot in this game that they mention it in Remake that there was this war between Shimmer and Wutai, and that is
Wutai as well. Yeah,
yeah, that's been pushed forward. So, and I imagine, whereas Wutai is a small town in the original, I have a feeling that Wutai will be much more defined as a country in whatever comes next.
Yeah, Wutai's a big one. I completely forgot. Yeah, so there is a reasonable amount of locations. I don't know about biomes though. We kind of only got snow one left, and everything else is kind of similar.
I am legit. Well, I mean, I've started this game like four times in my life. I'm legitimately thinking about just playing the original now because I am hungry for more. And I've only ever got. I don't think I've ever actually got through Midgar. I've played it like four times. I've never actually got through to like any of what this game was showing me. So I probably should do it. Just
in regards to the, I just want to go back to the Final Fantasy 16 thing. It's extra mad to me considering they were being developed like at similar times.
Yeah.
And one team is not looking at what another team is doing and seeing what can we do. Like 16 is so stripped back and minimal in comparison, which actually blows my mind. They came from the same, you know, publisher, really.
Yeah, but you've got, it's funny as well because Rebirth feels so maximalist, right? Like it has everything, almost to a degree to its detriment in the fact that there is so much here that it means that the quality bar can't be even across it. But when you look at them in like trailers, well, 16's the maximalist one because that's the one with all of these gigantic boss battles against deities that are, you know, kind of the magical equivalent to nuclear bombs. And yet, it's quite low-key what you play in that game aside from those boss fights. And it is essentially a game where you travel in straight lines through combat arenas into cutscenes. And for this to feel so much like a genuine adventure, which is absolutely exactly what the original Final Fantasy VII was, and it had to capture that to work. And it couldn't have, because I can remember when I was playing 16, I was doubting myself as I was like, is what I like about Final Fantasy, like, not real? Yeah. Does it not exist? Is it always a game where you just play combat bits and then move into cutscenes? And to play this and be reminded, no, I was right. Final Fantasy was always quite adventurous, and you did get to have a feeling of agency in the game and go and do cool things. It's very vindicating to me to remind myself Final Fantasy is good when it wants to be.
I do, like, want to almost toot my own horn, but go back to saying when we were talking about 16, I vividly remember saying like the biggest flaw for me was not having a party of playable characters, just being focused on one character. It's not Final Fantasy to me. It's about the team. It's always about the team going on an adventure.
That's exactly what this game is about. And that, like, you actually actively build bonds with them, and you can check, see how happy they are with you, and that all leads to the gold saucer, which, you know, you can go on a date with someone. Dale, you've actually seen all of these dates.
I've seen all the dates.
Which one is the one people should go for? Which is the best date scene?
Well, best in terms of like information you get, or best or just like fun to watch?
Just the most fun one without spoiling it. Or a couple.
So I got one which I imagine a lot of people won't get, but I think it's because I was going so fast. This is the reason I got it. But there's one, if you don't build up any relationships enough, You get one where you go with Kate Sif, Vincent, and what's his name?
Sid.
Sid. Yes, and you go as a three-way guy date. Sid actually says the lines of, there's nothing weird about three bros hanging out going to watch a play or something along those lines. And you just go out on a Skyworld date together and nobody really wants to talk and it's awkward and Kate Sif's trying to break the ice and it's just a bit of fun, you know?
So we're basically saying make no bonds with anyone. But that's probably the opposite way.
If you want bonds, honestly, I would say Yuffie, mainly because that was where I really found a moment where I made a connection with her at that point. At that point in the game, she's very much one note. She's just about, I want to get materia because I wanted to help Wu Tai, and she's all she focuses on. But then she has some real breakthrough moments in that Sky Realm.
Was it a Love is Blind moment? It's like you're in the pod in the Sky Realm.
You are in a pod, yeah, but you can see each other. Yeah. But honestly, all of them really have a lot of value, way much more than the original game, which Barrett, you could date Barrett and Yuffie in the original game and they were very much joke scenes. But now they're very much vehicles for emotional moments between characters where they can break through and talk about their shared insecurities and things, and every one of them has something like that, so there's a lot of value. And Red 13's one, you get some important story stuff that isn't told in any point of the game, so
there we go.
It's good stuff.
It's a fantastic game. If you're looking forward to this game, I don't think you're going to be disappointed. It's very, very fun.
Can we talk about one criticism though, or a couple of criticisms?
We talked about the story.
Okay, but I do want to say this thing that I've said to you guys before, but I want to say it. It's I do think everything in the game is about 20% too long all the time. And that's...
I'm not sure if everything is.
I think almost everything. But I think that falls in the fact of this is a 10-hour chunk of a game stretched out. The first game had that same problem. But I even think it comes down to mini games and sequences. I think everything... it always feels like it just goes just a little bit too long where I'm ready to move on.
I can honestly say there was only two, maybe three sections. One of the box throwing we talked about is not good. There's a mine sequence I thought was a bit long.
So I think it gets increasingly worse. So I don't have that problem in the first half of the game. Yeah. The longer it goes on, I think in the back half, it really does to
the
make
things
go on.
The penultimate chapter is probably an hour.
Yeah, that's way too long. Yeah, but I think even there's several sequences in the game. I think it probably about four different times where they force you to stop and say you have to do some mini games to progress.
Yeah, I did really like those bits. That's why I'm a sucker for in games like this, Persona games, where you always inevitably go on a school holiday for 5 days and just talk to people and have fun. I'm a sucker for those downtime bits in big RPGs.
I love the option of all these mini games, and a lot of them are good fun. But sometimes I just I didn't want to stop. I wanted to carry on with the story. And that's the way I play, I suppose. It was leaning to that, but yeah.
See, I agree with Cardi on this one, that I thought the pacing of this game was actually surprisingly strong for the most part. Right. It helps that I think Final Fantasy Remake was quite egregious with its pacing problems. Mm-hmm. And really in the back half was just we want everything to last longer. And so much so, moments that took 2 minutes in the original took 2 hours in Remake. And then they make you go back to shit characters and do more stuff with them that you didn't really want to do. I think this doesn't necessarily have that. But what I really like about this is... It's a game that is split up. The opening essentially is you do a big linear section, which you've probably played if you've played the demo, which is very story focused. And then you go into an open world section, and then you'll go into a linear section, and then you'll go into an open world section. So it's got a good set of pace there. Mm-hmm. But I think the way that it has those mandatory mini game sections, such as when you go to Costa del Sol for the first time, I think it's really, for me, who was playing it at about a 60-hour thing, that pacing felt right.
Okay.
Because it meant that I was having these moments of not high-octane energy fights or high-octane energy conversation. That's those heavy story beats. I was having a moment for these people to just be human beings, just to live and have a bit of fun. And so having that displayed through more frivolous mini-games... And you only have to really play them once each, in that section. Mm-hmm. That, for me, felt it aided the pace and it helped with the humanity of the story.
Sure, I can see that. I can see that.
Yeah. It's a big game. And it served a big chunk of time to talk about it. There we go. I like when we get to actually delve deep in on a game. It's a very, very good game. I really do love it. It's probably my favourite game of the year so
Definitely.
Far. We've only had 2 months. But we've already had some great games Like a Dragon, this. Helldivers chipping in away at that again and having a great time. And another game, which I'll talk about very soon, actually. But first, from one massive game to a massive film, me and you, Matt, we have seen Dune Part 2, which I was actually thinking about this. Actually very similar to Final Fantasy VII. And I know they're kind of both got the Star Wars links, that Star Wars was based on Dune, and Final Fantasy VII is essentially kind of based on Star Wars in a way, is what I'm getting. I'm getting a lot of it. I don't want to say based on, but there's a lot of parallels anyway. In as much as this film, I again really, really like, but kind of also, I think for me anyway, stumbles at the end and kind of fumbles some of its big moments like Final Fantasy does.
Yeah, to a certain degree, and it's definitely the middle story in a three-part structure, right?
I think the quickest way to say is if you like Dune from a few years ago, I think you're going to really like Dune Part 2. It's in the best way kind of more of the same, I think, than as much as nothing I've seen in cinemas, maybe apart from Top Gun Maverick recently, has like blown me away on like an audio visual scale in a cinema like the Dune films have. Like Denis Villeneuve's production design, his team on these films is absurd, and just every little, like, it's not even just the score, every like little like creaking mechanical sound in this film is just so, like, you can, like, it's so alien, but yet you can, so like, you can feel every like the bit of metal in it. It's just,
so I'm obsessed with the production design on this film. Like, it is everything. It's the same as what both Dune Part 1 and Blade Runner 2049 was. It speaks to me on such like a level that it's almost like direct to my soul in how much I love what I'm seeing on screen. But there's a sequence where the Harkonnen troops are going in, and they still do that thing where they float, which is so weirdly eerie and alien. It's just like nothing I've seen in sci-fi before. But their suits have got like this little like weird fan in the back of the head, and you see it in so many shots, but it doesn't spin like a normal fan. It's, I don't know how they've got it to look like it does. And you can just hear it like very quietly whirring. And it's obviously some sort of filtration device. But that is indicative of the wider design philosophy on this film. Are things that, you know, that Star Wars used future kind of aesthetic that they like. Mm. It's got that. But whereas everything in Star Wars looks like it's designed for sci-fi, this just looks like it was designed by a completely different civilization far away from us. It is genuinely alien feeling, even though they're made by humans.
But, and they're all meant to work as well. I remember when I talked to Denis Villeneuve for the first Dune, like, and we were talking about how he built like the Ornithops and stuff. It was like, and the suits and everything. It's like, actually designing and building it so it would all physically work. Like, if in theory this needed to happen and like could be built, it would work. Yeah. Like, and that's what you say about that filtration. There's no need to show you the filtration system on a suit of armor, but he's thought about it, they've designed it, and they've built it so it would work. And it's just, it really does make it feel like it is a place.
Yeah, and like, there's in that whole sequence, there's also a bit where kind of like Batista is stood behind a pilot. The pilot's helmet is one of the best props I've ever seen in a film. It is just so beautifully robust and believable, and unlike, the closest thing I could say is it reminds me a little bit of things I've seen in Cyberpunk, but very kind of dirty and sandy, I suppose is the right term. But yeah, like, production design, just incredible.
Just to look at and hear, this film is phenomenal, like, and especially what they do with the Harkonnen world and how they kind of use its sun to like paint, like you're watching a different film for like a 15-minute.
Oh, when they're on Gedi Prime,
the entire
film goes into almost like monochrome, right? Because the atmosphere is so oppressive that everything just appears in black and white.
Cool. And you've got Austin Butler being absolutely mad. It does delve more, like the first film did it as well. This one as well, like, delves into horror at times in like imagery, not in like scares or anything, but like the imagery is so like oppressively like gothic sci-fi horror at time. And like, there's it's a spoiler to say that the Baron gets in his bath again. Everyone will love that. He gets in his big tar bath. I think it looks phenomenal, sounds phenomenal, performances are phenomenal. I think anyone who doubted, for me anyway, that Timothy Chalamet like doesn't have like the power to pull off this role, I think he genuinely does display
in
it
the back half
has a
of
really
this film.
Good like guttural roar at times. Like, I don't want to spoil, like, it's an old story, but if you don't know what happens in Dune, like, it happens. it's, and I feel like this, and Zendaya actually as well, when I shout, is very, very good. Like, she doesn't have a lot to do in the first one, but in this film, she, like, is as much her film, I think, as it is.
I actually think she's the most important character in the entire film. Yeah. Like, obviously, Paul is the, you know, he's this messiah-like figure that is leading kind of the Fremen to, you know, to retake Dune is the whole kind of goal of the film. But Shani is a character, you know, she is the heart, and she is the political kind of angle that this film really required. She brings, which wasn't in the book, it was something that came in Dune Messiah, where Frank Herbert realized that not a lot of people really understood the idea that the Messiah figure in Dune is not supposed to be something that you immediately are just like, yeah, amazing. So that's where Dune Messiah comes in, to make it out that what Paul is doing is not necessarily something we should all be on board with. And I think Shani's character brings that into this film so incredibly well.
Yeah. It is magnificent, I think, but it's not without, I think, some flaws, which I think comes in, I think part of it is down to the fact of, this is a story that's been riffed on so many times that you at times don't feel like you're kind of waiting for a twist or something to happen that's not going to happen, because this is a story that has been told a lot of times. I do think it has, in its imagery and in its action scenes, enough to like surprise and like show you things you haven't seen before. But story-wise, it's kind of fairly A to B. And I know that it doesn't maybe go quite as weird as the book, and that's where you were maybe slightly disappointed in where it goes.
Matt, yeah, there's a sequence that I was waiting for, and it just never happens, which involves a baby, and that just never happens, which is sort of a shame. But also, I recognise that maybe that is so strange that it wouldn't necessarily fit the Villeneuve's version of Dune.
No, I feel that this does have a more satisfying ending than part one. I know a lot of people very much felt like part one built and built and built and then never, and then kind of ended, right? It kind of ended. I really liked that it kind of ended with an understated like sword fight, and then kind of that was it. Like, wait for part two, and we're lucky we got part two. But this does definitely has much, it has an ending, but definitely leaves the door open for a third film. So hopefully we do get that one day. I doubt we won't. But yeah, you're looking forward to it, Dale?
Very much so, actually. Like, do you know what? My dad used to watch the first Dune film a lot when I was a kid, and I hated it. And I was like, no interest in this whatsoever. And then when that film came out, there's something about it appealed to me. I watched it, and now I've seen it like three times since. Like, and now I'm into it. Maybe I should read the book as well, actually. Like, but
The book is genuinely great. Yeah. Like, it's obviously full of so much weirdness because of all like the Ben Gesserit and stuff. But this kind of story of a bunch of mad witches that do a psyop to create the Messiah is genuinely very interesting.
Do you know what? Maybe after I watch part two, then I'll read the book after that, I think, and see.
Yeah. Please be excited. I believe it's out next week. I think next Friday or next Saturday. I don't know. Please be excited for June. I'm going to all tell you about a new game soon, but first, let's take a little break.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Hello, my name is Alison Larkin, and I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of the Jane Austen podcast. This podcast brings Jane Austen's stories to the 21st century, along with commentary from me and conversations with fascinating people who all share a love of Jane Austen. And of course, we had to start with none other than Pride and Prejudice. So join me as we embark on a journey through some of the most wonderful stories I know. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And we're back, and I'm knee deep in another roguelike. It's happened again. I've caught the bug, the Balatro bug. Have either of you guys heard about Balatro?
No.
It seems to have cards involved, like actual aces.
So this is a roguelike of card proportions. I don't know what I'm talking about. It's basically a roguelike based around poker hands. So you score by playing poker hands. So if you don't know what a poker hand is, for example, a flush is five cards all of the same suit. So put five clubs down and you'll score. Or two pairs, so two cards of the same number down. And that's how you score points. Simple enough. But this game is all about bending the rules of poker and kind of cheating at poker in a way. And the way you go through these levels is you'll have four or five hands you get to play to score a certain amount of points, and you'll have a target for each round to get further and further. And I actually beat my first run late last night, so I've actually done one, which is good. And that's, I think it's like 24 battles roughly you'll have to do to get through. And you're just set, it's not really a battle, you're kind of just set a points target each time, and you go through like a roguelike, building up your deck of cards and building up, more importantly, these joker cards. So you'll have five at the top of your screen that kind of affect cards and ways of scoring in poker. So like my way has to be go with flushes, so I've tried to build a flush heavy kind of joker set. So for example, you earn currency and you buy these joker cards in the store after each round, and a joker card will say like four times multi-score on flushes. So obviously I want that one because I'm trying to get flushes in every hand, and that's what I'm building. Or like clubs and spades equate as the same suit. So like basically any black card now I put down counts as a flush. And it's all about kind of cheating at poker and kind of building up these specific scores you're trying to get, and watching the combo meter just go ridiculously high. So you're going like 200 times 147 multi like plier to get like 49,000 or whatever in a score. And it's just like that real like part of your brain that just enjoys seeing numbers tick and tick up really just gets me. It's kind of like that, it is that sort of like what you call it, like what am I thinking, a fruit machine thing of like just watching things spin round and winning. But like it's just, I'm just a sucker for a card-based roguelike, and this is really, really hitting the spot. I can't recommend it enough. It's out on Steam, PS5 and Switch, and I just, every time I, like, if you've been playing this game and you're going after flushes like I am, every time you see a Jupiter card pop up, your eyes glow, because you can also get these celestial cards, which are like all the different planets. And like, so like, I think Earth like relates to straights and Jupiter relates to flushes. So like you just want to keep collecting Jupiter cards, and that also ups how much a flush will score. And it's just, you kind of, this is the same with any roguelike basically, isn't it? Like early on in that run, you have to decide this is my strategy for the run and build all around it to try and score high. And I don't know, I'm just having such a good time playing Balatro. I can't stop.
That or Queen's Blood, if you had to choose one for the rest of your life.
Sorry?
If you had to choose one, Balatro or Queen's Blood for the rest of your life?
Balatro, unless Queen's Blood became a PvP game and I could play against other people on the internet. But I've done all I can of Queen's Blood now in fun. Like, there's no more
they
Queen's
should
Blood
release it as a mobile game, one that you can play online.
They might. They did it with Gwent, right, and The Witch. I don't know if this has quite the same, like, I don't know, room to grow as something like Gwent does, but we'll see. Yeah, I'm a sucker for card games, and Balatro is the best I've played in a long time. So if you want to lose your life to something, Get Balatro. That's Balatro if you don't know how Balatro is spelled, because it's not a real word. And I'm still not 100% sure why it's called that, to be perfectly honest. But I'm having a good time. Do you know who else is having a good time? All the people who write into IGN underscore UK feedback at IGN.com. It's the most fun you can do during the week is write us an email. So why not do it? We've got had a lot of Kit Kat correspondence and a lot of people writing in to tell us what TV shows scared them as a kid. A lot of these I've never actually heard of, so maybe you guys can enlighten us. But Matt, you've got the first email here, I believe.
Yeah, this is from Simon Brook, who says, "Hiya lads, as per your request for scary kid shows, I wanted to submit The Walking Nightmare that was CBBC's Moondial."
I don't know what this is.
So he says, "I'm older than water, so you guys might be too young for it, but it was essentially a time travel jape for kids with the pitch black oppressive tone of Hereditary. It's about a girl called Minty, whose parents are killed in a car crash in episode one, because that's what kids love, who finds a sundial that takes her back to the Victorian times to witness the absolutely wall-to-wall suffering of children back then. Perfect tea time viewing. There was a little Victorian girl called Sarah who had a birthmark on her face, and the Victorian kids thought that it meant she was evil. My enduring memory is a ritual in which a gang of masked kids made an effigy of Sarah and stomp on it and burn it, chanting, 'Devil's child, devil's child.' I was eating my fish fingers in front of the TV and being so frightened that my mum had to turn it off before I was sick. So awesome. I don't make them like that no more. Don't drown."
It had one season.
That's good advice.
One season in 1988. So
yeah, I've just looked up a picture of the kids, and it just the kids look terrifying. Yeah.
Can see why this didn't get picked up for further seasons.
You can get it all on. It's all on Amazon. $6.99 for all of it on DVD.
Interestingly, when I was reading that, I had a very very vague like recollection, and now I've gone on the Wikipedia, I recognise the sundial from it. So I think I have watched this at some point, because obviously as someone that is 35 years old, 80s things tended to get repeated when in my childhood. I watched a lot of 80s shows, so I think I have was it written by Helen Cresswell? What else did she write? I have a feeling that she did like the Famous Five and Phoenix in the Carpet and stuff like that, and the Demon Headmaster.
Or did like Phoenix in the Carpet.
So yeah, I have a feeling that at some point this was part of my childhood, but I have not the horrendous memories that Simon has suffered.
No, but I might check out a bit of it on YouTube, you know. It sounds horrible. I've not thought about Phoenix in the Carpet in a long time. What a mad thing that was.
Just a bit.
God. I'm having weird flashbacks. Dale, we've got another email. Save me from my own thoughts.
This email straight from Albert Square, it looks like, as well, because this comes from one Nick Cotton. Sorry, Nick. I'm sure you've had that your entire life. Hi, IGN UK team. First time, long time, and that. On the subject of great TV shows that are in dire need of a reboot, does anyone remember The Interceptor on Channel 4? Imagine a cross between The Running Man and Orienteering Course at Scouts, and you're halfway there. I do not know this. Do you guys know this?
Not a clue.
I've definitely seen it when I was young. I have vague memories of the opening credits of like a big helicopter.
Okay.
Like going over a lake.
Well, Nick goes on to explain the premise. The premise was this: two contestants are each given a locked backpack, one containing money and one containing weights to simulate money. They each have a key for the other's backpack. Then they're blindfolded and dropped off 5 miles apart, usually around some quaint English village surrounded by farmland. They have to meet up and exchange keys, guided through the earpieces by Dad's favourite Annabelle Croft, who usually sets up in the village hall, flanked by members of local government desperate to get on the telly for 5 minutes. So far, so harmless, right? Enter The Interceptor. A blonde Scottish man dressed like an Audi Terminator is hunting your plucky contestants with a laser gun. He shoots the receptors on the back of the backpack 2 or 3 times, and it's locked forever. Sorry, if he shoots them, I assume. It's locked forever. Oh, and he's got a goddamn helicopter. I swear this wasn't an elaborate fever dream. I seem to remember him having some bizarre crow screech call that he'd make when he was near.
I definitely watched this.
Okay. I'm sure it only ran for 1 or 2 seasons. Helicopters aren't cheap to run, I guess. Anyway, apologies for the length of this, but I needed to give you all the batshit details. Respect the sea, gravediggers, and discount supermarket cyborgs. Nick.
If I remember rightly, it was speaking of Nick Cotton, it was actually similar like vibe and time as Fort Boyard.
Oh, really?
Which obviously Nasty Nick presented. Or was it Dirty? No, Dirty Den.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Like, yeah.
Getting it all mixed up now. But yeah, definitely, I'm going to watch some clips of this. I found actually a video, I'll send it to you after, of 3 minutes of highlights of Interceptor.
What was the show? And it was nothing like this, but there's a helicopter where reminded me of it, where, oh, it was like Annika Rice in it with the helicopter. What was that called? Oh, my God. she used to fly around in a helicopter and do stuff. It was a kid's show and had Annika Rice in it. That's all I can tell you.
Oh, Treasure Hunt.
Yeah, I guess that's what it was, yeah.
Yeah. I was also thinking of Come Outside with Auntie May.
in the spotty plane with the dog.
I think it was Challenge Annika, actually, I think it was.
God, there's so many of So, like, what do kids watch these days? That's what I want to know. That isn't Bluey.
Yeah.
That's the only kids' TV show I know.
Hey Dougie, yeah. that's what my nephew's into.
And Bluey's for younger kids as well. You know, we're looking at shows. What are the shows for, like, 11-year-olds? And so,
yeah, what are they haunting kids with these days?
I suppose.
Or is it, you wouldn't get Interceptor anymore, would you?
They just don't watch TikTok now, I guess, don't they? No time for shows anymore.
Nah. I've got some important Kit Kat correspondence here from Rick Powell, who says, Hi, IGN crew. Hope all are well. Long time, third time, etc. Just wanted to wade in on the Kit Kat discussion to firstly say the best form factor is the chunky. The others just don't have the thick enough layer of chocolate. I have to agree. It's chunky all
But
the
Kit
way.
Kats, the originals are the original. You know, like, chunky was the new boy on the block. But
originals can be improved.
I'm not sure about that. I like the split. The fact that you can choose to have one and then just, you know, there's a nice pause in between.
Who does that, though? Who just takes one?
Are you one of those madheads that eats it, like, keeps the four connected and then just bites?
Oh, no. No, I never get four fingers. But you eat them one after another.
I split them and then bite the ends off and then bite the chocolate off around the side. And
if it's just a two finger, I probably will just eat the two fingers and I won't split the two.
Oh, no. Always split. Always split.
Yeah.
I just have to, I rarely have a Kit Kat anyway, but if I do, it will be a chunky. Anyway. Rick continues, secondly, wanted to say the best flavour hands down is banana.
What?
I've never been a fan of banana flavoured sweets. They're always artificial in flavour. But the banana ones I had from Japan are hands down my favourite. A chunky version of those would slap so hard. I've attached a picture of my wife and I's haul of Kit Kats from our first trip to Japan. Respect the sea, gravediggers, and many other professions that don't get the credit they deserve. We have got a picture. We have to describe this. Is when I say that this is a picture of about 30 different types of Kit Kats. I'm not overstating that. It's an absurd. It's a whole dining table is covered, basically.
There's peach, there's grape, wasabi, obviously.
I think I see the one that's kind of a cheesecakey one that reminds me. I think my favorite one in Japan, they had, it was either creme brulee or something very similar to like a creme brulee flavored Kit Kat.
There's one that looks like.
It was very good.
There's an apple flavor one here. Yeah. Another one that looks like it's just cheese and wine. And grapes,
cheese and wine. Where's the cheese and wine?
I can just see a picture of like a glass of wine and
there's grapes. Oh. There's a grape.
Oh, it's grapes. Yeah.
People not looking at the one that appears to be a sandwich flavor.
Where's that?
Is that the one on the far right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Under the apples, it looks like a Nutella sandwich, maybe.
Yeah, that's like a little pie or something. It's hard to make out. I think there's a.
Oh, no, that's like a little. That's like the little, like Japanese little, like filled pancakes. Isn't it? Or is it like a Nutella? It's hard to tell. That might be like a Nutella sandwich. We might need some annotations here, Rick. We're a little confused, but I see the peach one. The peach one. Is good.
The kiwi say, one there. As well? Is that kiwi?
I'm very much into following Rick's advice because I love banana flavored things. I don't actually like bananas as a fruit.
I hate bananas.
But I love banana ice cream is one of my favorites. I love banana yogurt, anything like that. So a banana Kit Kat, I would be well for if it was a chunky.
Bananas, Simon. Hate bananas.
Yeah, the texture, the mushy texture, but I can't stand the texture of a banana. Yeah, I've always hated
my bananas. My lad's got bones pit. He's well into banana brekkie at the moment.
Well, things change. Like when I was a kid, I would not stop eating baked beans. Then around the age of 8 or 9, I hated baked beans ever since.
I still regularly eat baked beans all the time. Come on.
A lot of people do. It's the texture, the mush. They're saying about that mushy like texture of beans and like bananas and things. I don't know. Not for me. I'd eat one if you made me. But, you know, I'm not going to enjoy it. But yeah. God, I want a Kit Kat chunky now. But yeah. such is life. What a fantastic episode of the IGN UK podcast. That's what you're going to get every week. IGN underscore UK feedback at IGN.com for whatever you want to talk to us about. We'll probably talk about it as long as it's reasonable and legal. What music should we have at the end? It's got to be a bit of Final Fantasy, isn't it? But what, there's so much. We don't even touch on the music. The music is just so
music
good.
From Cosmo Canyon. I think that might be
also awesome. I want to shout out my favorite track in this entire game was in Cosmo Canyon when you're just in the world area. When you go into battle, they do a remix of just the world environment music as the battle track. It absolutely fucking slaps.
The music is so good in this remake as well.
I mean, even just the standard battle film is theme is incredible. I really, we didn't talk about Final Fantasy, and the piano minigame is so good. We get to play some of the themes. I love Tifa's theme. Tifa's theme is so good.
Also, how did you get on playing that? Because I found it really easy to get into because I know Tifa's theme by heart. I can hum it.
I was okay with it. I'm just okay with kind of like rhythmy games like that. So
I find I could predict like what the next one was going to be because I know it.
Like, even though I haven't played the original Final Fantasy, that music is kind of ingrained. I've heard that music so many times, whether at events or like live orchestra. I know most of the music from this game, weirdly. So,
did you not find it difficult playing the piano with... I found it doing two sticks at once. That's the bit that I found really tricky.
Yeah, the right stick was much easier.
I'd focus on the right stick, and then in the corner of my peripheral, I'd see the left one. I'm like, oh shit, and I'd always end up hitting the wrong part of it.
Some of them are nailed. Yeah. But good fun. Anyway, here's what the Cosmo Canyon... just theme, is that what it's called? I don't know.
Probably.
We'll play it anyway. Enjoy. Goodbye.
Bye.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the side?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.